it's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome, welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. Once again, I'm Gene Bolduc, your host, and I have with me the doctor. The doctor is in, Dr. Aaron Keck.
Hello.
Hello, hello, thank you.
How are you?
I'm a little bit worried about the world and our democracy, but you're going to straighten me out on these things that I worry about.
That's good, because this show is starting at a dark place.
It's starting in a dark place, but we're going to turn some lights on, and everybody's going to feel better. And as we say in the internet world, I'm just going to leave this right here, and then when anybody needs to come back and understand some of these issues, I hope that they'll come back and remember that they heard it first. Right, not really. On the Weekend Water Cooler. So here's my great big $64,000 question. That's a reference from the 50s that nobody will get. Well, Ron Stelz will get it. how is it that we live in a country, Dr. Keck of American government instructional fame, how is it that we live in a country where about 3 or 3.5 out of 10 Americans set the agenda and operate and rule the country on principles and with policies that probably about 6.5 to 10 out of 10 Americans don't agree with? That is, why do we live under minority rule? How did this happen? And are we under, and I, you know, not for nothing, are we not under threat for this to get worse?
Go into more detail, Gene Bolduc.
Oh, come on.
In what way are we under minority rule?
Well, so for example, to take the easiest and most obvious example, millions more people voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump.
Okay.
But he's president because of the Electoral College, and that Donald Trump got votes ostensibly, not according to Jimmy Carter, by the way, in all the right places to win the Electoral College and win the presidency. The Electoral College was designed to even out the basis of power, it's fair to say, between and among the states and in presidential elections. But Al Gore lost the 2000 election because of that phenomenon of the Electoral College.
Right.
And now Hillary Clinton lost the election in 2016 because of that in the Electoral College. There's pretty good scholarship that says that Donald Trump could lose the Electoral College by 5 million votes this time because of a larger turnout. There's more Americans voting and still win the presidency. So talk to me a little bit about how not so much the path to Trump winning re-election, but the phenomenon of the Electoral College and how does it work? Let's talk about the basic things first.
Okay.
How does it work? And why do you think there's such a push right now? And it seems to be kind of a sustained push to get rid of it.
Well, for exactly the reason that you said. I mean, we in America care about democracy, right? At least to a significant degree.
Right.
So, of course, when you've got kind of back-to-back elections like this in 2016, so not back-to-back, but close enough to each
close
other
enough.
That
a lot of people, everybody remembers
memory,
it,
right? That there's now a push to say, hey, we're a democratic country. We care about democratic values. We should have a system where the person who gets the most votes wins. So that's the reason for the sustained push. It's a fascinating story, the Electoral College, because you go all the way back to the writing of the Constitution.
Right.
In 1787. The framers were concerned about a whole bunch of different things. Some of them were legitimate concerns, and others were sort of, well, what if kind of things that never came to pass. But one of the things that they were really concerned about was they've got all of these different institutions. They've got the presidency, they've got the House, they've got the Senate, they've got the Supreme Court, these four kind of big institutions of the national government. And they really wanted to make sure that there was not just a separation of those four institutions, but that there was a balance. And in order for the four institutions to kind of check and balance each other. They wanted to make sure that the same people didn't get to choose who was in the Senate
right.
and the House
right.
and the presidency and the Supreme Court. So they said, okay, well, let's have four different ways of putting people in these offices. House of Representatives will make it really easy. We'll split the country up into districts, and every district votes, and whoever gets the most votes wins that seat.
Right.
We'll do that every 2 years.
Right.
That's the House of Representatives.
So they will – 2 years, and that way they will stay close to the people.
Close to the people, exactly,
right.
And it's just a direct Democratic election. The Senate – we'll have it be every 6 years, and now, because of the 17th Amendment, we directly elect our senators. But that wasn't the way it was in the Constitution. In the original Constitution, it was senators are going to be every 6 years, and we'll have the state legislatures appoint them.
So the
state governments got to pick the senators, and they served every 6 years.
Just think who we'd have right now if our state legislature – well, we'd probably have the two senators that we have.
We'd probably have the two senators that we have, yeah.
Right. Oh,
maybe
goodness.
Actually not. So much, yeah.
Yeah, right. Not anymore.
So that's the Senate. And the Supreme Court will have them serve for life.
Right.
And we'll have this be an appointment process where the president nominates the Supreme Court justices and the Senate confirms the Supreme Court justices. And we really want to make the Supreme Court a less democratic institution.
Right.
For a legitimate reason, we want judges to be able to make the right decision without having to check the newspapers and see what public opinion is that day.
Right.
So it's a less democratic institution. They serve for life, but they're chosen in that way. And now we've got the president. Man,
what
we've
are we
going to
do with
appointment.
Him?
Yeah. We've already got direct election. What do we do with the presidency? Ooh, I know what. Let's have a system where the people vote or actually no, state governments get to decide
right.
how this is done, but the states will appoint electors and the electors will meet together
right.
and cast their votes every 4 years for the president and the vice president, and that's the only thing they do. The electors are selected for this one purpose. They do their thing and then they disband forever. So they're completely disinterested.
Right.
They don't have a stake one way or the other. They're just
wow.
doing what the elector or what the voters in their state tell them to do, and that's it. And that's the reason why we have this weird system called the Electoral College, because they needed a fourth way
right.
to appoint a president. And over the course of American history, it's worked fairly okay mm-hmm. for the most part. Once we got to the point where people were able to actually go to the polls and vote for president, for the most part, the popular vote and the Electoral College have worked out. There
right.
was it 1824 when Andrew Jackson won the popular vote but didn't win the presidency. There were a couple years in the late 1800s, I think 1876, when Samuel Tilden won the popular vote, but Rutherford B. Hayes won the presidency, and that was the bargain with the South that will end Reconstruction. 1888, I think, was the other one where Grover Cleveland won the popular vote, but Benjamin Harrison won the presidency. And then you have these 2 years, 2000
and 2016. I had no idea there were that many occurrences.
It was those five.
Wow.
Yeah.
But really, you know, 5 out of 45 elections
is a decent number, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
you got to look at it. I
yeah.
mean, when it's that many, you got to look at it.
Yeah.
But like our healthcare mm-hmm. system. This is a system that if you were inventing it today, you would never have come up with
almost
this.
Almost certainly not. No.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Because there are just so many things in our society that are completely different,
and yeah.
primarily the ability for people to communicate with each other.
Yes.
It's a big deal.
And part of the reason they set the system up the way they did in 1787 was because they were a lot less enamored with the idea of democracy than we are today.
Right.
We, over the course of 200 plus years, have gotten more and more and more convinced of the idea that just democracy is a good thing, that the people ought to have a say in
right.
the laws. It's why we're having this conversation.
Right.
Why is it that this minority – percentage of the American people have such a disproportionate say over what gets done and not done, that's a real concern for us today. It wouldn't have been so much in 1787. So they were fine setting up this less than democratic institution. Now we look at it and we say, why do we have this outdated, antiquated thing?
Right. And I think that when you add to it, or even as a multiplier, the income inequality that syncs up with it pretty obviously.
Yes.
It feels like a democratic emergency to claw back the powers that the electorate has to regain control of this process.
And I think we need to focus on the real question of, okay, what does the Electoral College do? Who does it give more power to? Because the pushback against, oh, let's get rid of the Electoral College, and there is this movement to get rid of the Electoral College.
Yeah.
You'd have to do it on the national level. You'd have to do it with a constitutional amendment. That's difficult. But state by state, every state gets to determine how the electors
are set.
And there's this really interesting, clever
it's
movement.
Absolutely fabulous.
Where individual states will say, okay, once we hit a threshold where 270 electoral votes worth of states all do the same thing, then we'll all together pledge to give our electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote, regardless of how our state ends up shaking out. And if enough states get together to do that, then they can still have the Electoral College, but it's basically obsolete. But the pushback against this is, oh, well, it gives more power to the smaller states. It gives more power to the rural states like Wyoming or Montana or Delaware,
Idaho,
Rhode Island would have more power under the Electoral College than they otherwise would because they get like a disproportionate number of electoral votes. That's the argument. It's a crap argument because the Electoral College does not give more power to Wyoming and Montana and Delaware and Alaska and Hawaii and all these small states.
It's the Senate. It's the Senate that gets the ridiculous amount of disproportionate power.
Where the Electoral College gives the disproportionate powers to the swing states, right?
Right.
The North Carolinas, the Michigans, the Ohios, the Floridas,
those of
the
us
Pennsylvanias.
Those of us who cannot stop the robocalls from coming because if we need one more reminder that we're a swing state, oh my God, my email is just
that is where the conventions take place every 4 years. That's why the RNC is going to be in Charlotte this year. That's
they
why the Democratic convention was in Charlotte in 2008, am I right, or 2012? 2012,
yes.
That's why all of the campaign stops are in the swing states. That's why the Democrats held their debate in Florida. They focus so heavily on the voters and the specific narrow interests of these particular states to the complete exclusion of every other state in the country.
That's right. Sorry, Hawaii. They're never coming
They're never coming to you, right? So if we got rid of the Electoral College, then it would be a full national election. Every vote would count.
They're still not going to Idaho, though.
As much as every other. I think if they did that, then the focus would end up being on cities because you can buy a TV ad in Chicago and reach a lot more voters than you can by buying a TV ad in Boise.
That's true. You could buy the whole TV station in Boise for what an ad cost in Chicago.
Also true, right. Yeah. So I think that might end up being a concern with a popular vote. The other concern with the popular vote would be if we had another election like 2000.
That was razor sharp,
razor
close.
The vote came down, where the vote was so close that you could count the votes five different times and come up with five slightly different results.
Right.
You'd have chaos, but we kind of did anyway in 2000. So
I think we've had a fair amount of chaos lately, too, but it's a different thing. Well, we're over time, of course. So we're going to take a quick break with Aaron Keck, who's going to now take a deep breath. I think for the first time in about 7 minutes. Did you ever swim as a kid?
I did, how do you do
that? I don't know.
My grandparents taught me how to swim in Michigan.
Okay.
In between political ads.
That's right, in between political ads. Well, so that was for short periods of time. And anyway, so we're going to come back and talk some more about this. We're going to talk some more about gerrymandering and the census and some of these wonderful topics that you can't wait to hear from Aaron about. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back with Dr. Aaron Keck, and we're talking about the prospective unemployment of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. Okay, I said his name. Now he will be he who shall not be named.
There are a lot of he who shall not be named American politics.
Instead of calling them the deplorables, we'll just call them the Voldemort, you know, as a plural application. It's a category
But it's pronounced the same way, Voldemort and Voldemort, because it's a French thing. The S is silent.
Oh, yeah. May we. Okay. The S is silent. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Mitch McConnell, I can't believe I said it just right away. Anyway, this poor slob from Kentucky, he has an amount of power right now that is demonstrating why he shouldn't have that much power. I don't know if it's just the rules of the Senate, might be to some extent. But he can block virtually anything from coming to the floor of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate used to be, I think it's fair to say, isn't right now, but used to be the world's famous, at least, political deliberative body. They don't, senators of both sides of the aisle are complaining about this now.
Yes.
That they can't bring bills forward. All they're doing is confirming judges and maybe a couple of appropriations bills that would just shut everything down if they weren't passed.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, they're just not doing the business of the people and of the American government. And a big chunk of the reason for this is that the Senate Majority Leader is saying, no, nothing's coming through. We're not doing that. We're just not doing that stuff. My first question is—
And he's doing that with, and I think you're going to say this anyway, he's doing that with bills that are very popular and, in fact, bipartisan.
And there's no
and
doubt—
And he's doing it precisely
because
they're popular
if they came and bipartisan. And background checks is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And if that bill came to the floor, one of the reasons that he's blocking it at the door, won't allow any discussion of it and so forth, is that he knows it will pass, and it will pass in a veto-proof majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one guy can do that. Please tell us why that is and what we can do about it. What can we do about it?
So the reason it is that the rules of the Senate are set up that way. And what we can do about it is elect new senators.
That's really our only recourse, right?
Right now it is. Yeah. Well, no. There are two recourses. So the thing about the Senate, and this also goes back to 1787. This is when the framers are writing the Constitution again. They're concerned about, among other things, they're concerned about the whims of public opinion,
right,
and people just getting very passionate about a particular issue and going down not so great roads. This is a legitimate fear. We've seen this happen countless times throughout American history. Sometimes the government is good about stopping it and sometimes it's not. But they were very concerned about that, and so they put in this system of checks and balances, right? One of the primary purposes of checks and balances is to slow down the system.
Right.
To make it very, very difficult to get big things passed so that when someone proposes a big thing, it's not going to pass unless they can get a lot of people on board with it.
Right.
So,
and that they really know what they're voting for.
Yes.
They have the structural support that they can take their time evaluating a bill, studying it, holding hearings. They were doing that long, long ago, holding hearings to evaluate things.
And this is why the Senate is set up the way it is. It's set up, the reason it was the most deliberative body, the most famous deliberative body in the world, is partly because it's one of the very few deliberative bodies where there's no time limit on debates,
right?
Which does enable the filibuster. You can get up and speak forever,
but as long as you can stand there,
it means that we can talk and talk and talk until we decide we're ready to vote. You've got the filibuster rule, the filibuster is a possibility. You've got the cloture vote rule where you need 60 senators or 3/5 of the senators to vote to stop debate and proceed to a vote. And you've got the Senate Majority Leader, who has an inordinate amount of power over which bills get brought to the floor, which is also something you kind of – you want someone to have some power over that, because – hundreds and hundreds of bills get introduced. If they all go immediately to the floor, then you'll have chaos. You want someone to have some
have
say over which
stuff.
Bills.
Yeah.
Right. You want some management there. But all of those things put together mean that it's always been really difficult to get something through the Senate. And sometimes that's a good thing when you have like a nativist racist popular movement that gains a lot of popular support, like in the 1840s and 50s with the Know Nothing movement, and when the Klan was particularly dominant in the early 20th century. But especially with the Know Nothing movement, like they never really got anything through the Senate, even though it was a really popular movement. They never really got anything passed, partly because of the difficulty of getting things passed. Flip side of that is when we actually should be passing things, it also takes forever, right? So the civil rights movement in the 20th century goes and goes and goes for decades before they finally start passing real civil rights bills like they did in 1964. That was a 100-year fight to get to that point because of how difficult it is in the Senate.
Right, so, and to Johnson's credit, I mean, so here you have the unfortunately elevated to the presidency, Lyndon Johnson, a longtime veteran of the U.S. Senate, really knew how to wield power in the Senate.
Yes.
And what he did in 1964, very simply, is to stand on the back of a martyred president and say, we're going to do this now. We're going to lose. The Democratic Party is going to lose the South for a generation.
Yeah.
But we're going to get this done, and we're going to stand on this.
And Kennedy was kind of pushing for the Civil Rights Act, but was having difficulty. And you're right. Johnson takes over and does exactly that.
And Johnson
and
kind
gets
of
it through.
Johnson, frankly, kind of branded it that way, that, you know, I'm doing this as a completion of the work of President Kennedy. You could say to some extent trying to separate himself from it, but he also was running for president in his own right.
Yeah.
And wanted to stand on that and get those votes to the extent that he could. But then they needed the Voting Rights Act
but
in 1965.
But then we hold that up as being a particularly great moment in the history of American government, but we're already reaching back 50 plus years to get to that.
Right.
So that's a rare occurrence. Most of the time, when we want something to pass, we look at the Senate and we say, come on, guys, you need to do this a little bit faster, and they're not. And it really makes it easy if you're Mitch McConnell. I've said it again. If you are that guy and you have that position of authority and you want to just not do anything at all, you can very easily use your power in the Senate to not do anything at all. So we're talking about minority rule in American
and
government.
That's one of the most glaring examples of how it's – how Voldemort is running the Senate, ruling with an iron fist
and
to have his
case,
way, because he does not have the people behind him.
And in this case, it's not a question of minority rule in terms of McConnell being able to push unpopular things through the Senate, because he's not actually doing that.
It's entirely about prevention.
What he's doing is shutting down popular movements. And we were coming up with all kinds of different things. On LGBT rights, for instance, you've got the Equality Act, which is extremely popular across the board. Democrats, Republicans, independent Republicans are in favor of this now, that gays and lesbians and trans people should not be discriminated against on the basis of sexual orientation
which
or gender identity.
Which basically adds them as a protected class to the Civil Rights Act, which, you know, I'll just say – you know, in the Civil Rights Ordinance of Orange County, that I was in there with my pencil with the first draft, we had that in there.
Yes.
We took it out so it would get passed. In the North Carolina legislature, believe me, that was never going to happen. We pushed as hard as we could push, but we had to take it out to get, you know, 95% of what we wanted.
Right.
And it's been all this time ever since.
Yeah.
And really, my understanding is, at least, that the Equality Act, what it does is expands the category of protected classes and then just And then just says, you know, these folks too.
These two as well. Yeah. It's called adding the four words, like take the race, sex, religion, national
origin,
ethnicity,
right.
and add sexual orientation and gender identity. Right. Very, very popular, bipartisan support. Mitch McConnell has the power to stop it, so he does.
And it would sail through the Senate.
Sail through the Senate.
Yeah. I mean, it would be law because it would be absolutely veto-proof.
Yeah. Protections for DACA recipients. Extremely popular across the board. But McConnell is shutting it down.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about that because I don't get that. I think that would take so much pressure off them that it just makes no sense to me. But you're going to make it make sense to me. We're going to come back in just one minute's time.
Okay.
We're taking a quick break.
All right.
And you're listening, I hope, on the edge of your seat.
Because we still have to talk about how we stop this, too.
Yes, we have to get to that part.
I said there were two ways.
That's right.
There are two ways.
Yeah, and you're just going to have to hang on until we get back. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler with our guest Aaron Keck on 97.9 The Hill. Please don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back. See, that went by very fast for me. How about for you? You're like in the middle of a sentence,
so just jump right back in.
Tell me exactly where you were.
Wait, who am I again?
Who are you?
We're back with The Weekend Water
I'm going to say we're back with I'm Gene Bolduc, and I think we're talking to Aaron Keck.
I think you're
still Aaron Keck. Yes.
So far.
Yes. Yeah, so the doctor of the philosophy of American government. So please tell me more. Tell me more.
So we're talking about the U.S. Senate. We're talking about the ability of a minority of the U.S. Senate to basically just shut things down. And we're seeing this with Republicans, with Mitch McConnell. Republicans who actually do technically have a majority of the U.S. Senate. So it's not like it's a minority there. But we're talking about bills that would very easily pass with – widespread bipartisan support that Mitch McConnell in particular is shutting down. So immigration, for one.
Yeah,
you wanted to talk about the Dream Act. Yeah.
And please tell me, explain to me like I'm a three-year-old, because in this area, I really am. It seems to me that passing the Dream Act would take a lot of pressure off the Republicans on the issue of immigration from a demographic that they're not going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't they do it?
Because Trump doesn't want it, and anyone who is in the Republican Party and defies Trump will get primaried out the next time they run for re-election.
It's just that?
I'm pretty sure it's just that, yeah. So, I mean, someone who's listening who can shed more light on this can correct me if I'm wrong, but I kind of think that's what it comes down to.
If you have another idea about that, please tweet it out and – and, you know, use the hashtag WTF or
I think
or WCHL perhaps
or
both.
Yeah.
I think that's what it comes down to because there actually
is a lot of support among Republicans for protecting Dreamers. There's a lot of support among Republicans for any of the several immigration, like comprehensive immigration bills that bipartisan groups of legislators have sat down and worked out. Like they've done this several times in the last couple of years and they've come up with proposals that are comprehensive. They're imperfect. They're not going to solve all the world's problems, but they address the issue in a meaningful way. This is Donald Trump's signature issue and Donald Trump doesn't want a solution. He doesn't want a solution. He wants to be able to. He wants his solution and nothing else. And
his solution is the wall.
The fact that won't actually solve anything.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
the fact that it won't actually solve anything
is fine with him.
Is a feature, not a bug.
I do believe
that Trump thinks the wall will solve all the world's problems. I will give him that much credit. But if it gets built, it won't. And when it doesn't, he'll be fine with that because he'll still be able to go up in front of the cameras and yell about immigrants.
Well, I saw a story that said that the whole thing with the wall and him talking about the wall at rallies is something that his campaign staff just sort of put that in his notes, in his bullet point notes, just to remind him, just as an avatar, to just remind him to talk about immigration. And it just took off because of its simplicity of the call and response with the audience, and that this just became, took on its own life. I can believe some of that, especially the part where this isn't really a thing that he has some sort of deep philosophical belief about. It's just that he can envision it. It's simple. And the idea is, I'm in a castle. I need a moat. I need a wall. And, you know, that works for him.
I think it's a political thing. I think it's
absolutely
the fact
become that,
that,
yes.
The Republican Party is all in on Donald Trump, and anyone who stands up to Trump in the Republican Party or does something that Trump doesn't want is in danger of getting primaried out. So you do see occasionally people standing up to Trump. You see John McCain doing it on healthcare. You see Justin Amash doing it on impeachment.
That's probably the end of that list right there, right?
Yeah, there's a couple others, but, you know.
Mitt Romney has said things.
Right. Susan Collins has said things.
Has said things.
Lisa Murkowski said things. Yeah. Actually, no, Lisa Murkowski has done things. She has voted. Right. She did vote no on healthcare, too. Rand Paul has said
on repealing health care.
Yes.
On repealing the ACA.
And another issue on which McConnell has shut things down is guns. You've got a couple of it's a very highly charged debate, but you've got a couple of proposals like universal background checks, red flag laws that allow judges to take guns away from people who have been deemed to be a threat to themselves or others.
Banning the bump stocks.
Those three things have widespread support among Democrats, Republicans, independents.
Right.
Universal background checks in particular. I talked with Tom Jensen of Public Policy Polling, and he's got this great line about how you can get 5% of Americans to agree with anything. Like you can do a poll and 5% of Americans will say they believe that all of the world's leaders are secretly 12-foot space lizards in disguise. And I'm not kidding. Actually, there's a poll that says that.
I think that might be true, though.
Yeah. So when you do a poll and 90% of Americans are in favor of background checks, you don't see that anywhere.
No,
but
right.
But McConnell, because he has the power of the Senate, can shut that down.
Well, I can't wait to see this race against McConnell. I'm sure he's going to run to keep his seat. And I can't wait to see his opponent. And, I'm sure that the Democratic Party is just licking their chops to run against him and just throw everything they have against him.
But here's the thing. There are two things that we can do as the people.
Thing one.
In order to prevent this. Thing number one is go to the polls and vote. And it honestly doesn't matter because Kentucky is a pretty red state. McConnell, when he runs for re-election, will probably get re-elected in Kentucky just because that's the state it is. But
so discouraging.
It's about the makeup of the Senate in general. You can bring bills to the floor and have a vote if they are popular bills and if you have someone in that position of Senate Majority Leader who is willing to bring those bills to the floor. And all it takes for that to happen is for the Democrats to retake the Senate.
That's right.
So we can do this in 2020 Tom Tillis is up for re-election.
That's right.
He's going to be vulnerable. It's going to be a really close race in North Carolina.
I think he already has a primary opponent, right?
Yeah. He'll get past the primary.
I think he will, but he's going to have to expend some resources to do that. I think that's a good sign.
So that's thing number one. Go to the polls and vote.
And there's no replacement for thing number one.
Right. Thing number two is take it to the streets. The one thing that is always, always, always true, and this is true regardless of what form of government you have, we've seen it in Hong Kong very recently where—
Wasn't that amazing?
These are people who live in a not very democratic government. They have some say, there are some elections, but it's the Chinese government. It's undemocratic.
Right.
But— regardless of what form of government you have, the people always have the ultimate power, not philosophically, but really, because we have the numbers.
That's right.
If we decide as a collective to just get up and walk out and go into the streets one day. And if enough of us do that, we can shut the system down tomorrow.
Even
if
the
we
Doobie
want to
Brothers
do that.
Knew this, right, about taking it to the street.
Well, exactly.
We,
you
know, maybe we can get AJ to drop a little clip of that music in at the end of the segment. But we're gonna come back and extend on this for just a moment. We're talking with Aaron Keck here on the Weekend Water Cooler. Learning about our American government, you can't learn too much about the American government. It's a fascinating area. So we're going to come back and wrap it up with Aaron, listening to the Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. And we're back, wrapping it up with Aaron Keck. I don't know. Does time change? Does time change its nature when I have you on this program? Because it seems to me that we have an hour-long program, and it seems like we talk for 5 minutes, and we say, oh, we're out of time.
Time's nature is ever-changing, Gina. Okay,
oh, geez,
so—
see, now he's just throwing
science at me. I have talked a lot. You have talked for probably about 5 minutes of the show. So
that's okay.
I'm done.
This should be on you. This is about dragging great stuff out of your guests. Well, here's
bring it home.
So here's my takeaway, which is, I learned shortly after Donald Trump took office about the wonderful work of a group called Indivisible. Which, if you haven't, if you're not up to speed about Indivisible, just go online and Google the word Indivisible, and you might see, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance. But what you're also going to find is a wonderful document that's not a big, you know, it's not the Mueller report. It's like, I don't know, 20 pages long or something, and it was written by staffers on the Hill. I think both from the House and the Senate side, staffers who are a little bit in their own right were a little bit frustrated with the fact that Trump got elected and concerned that the democracy itself was at risk. And so what they did is they produced this incredible document and have now created activist groups. There's chapters all over the country. You can join a chapter very easily. You'll find them online in 12,000 different ways. And what the document is, which is their constitution, basically, is it's a guidebook of activism when it comes to lobbying, citizen lobbying of your member of Congress. And they give you these step-by-step, incredibly practical guides about conducting citizen-based organic activism. And I mean, these are granular, some of them. So, for example, they tell you don't go to a rally and have a sign that's blank on one side. Because if you do, somebody's going to photograph it from the side that's blank, and they're going to put their own message on it with your face if they have an opportunity where you're holding up a sign that you happen to be displaying the blank side of it. So make sure that your message is on both sides. Things like, it used to be back in the day, it was, you know, call your congressman or call or write your congressman. Well, if you wanted to call your congressman or congressional representatives, that's a great idea. If you want to write and send them an angry email or tweet at them, I guess that they count those, but those are not really the things that, especially senators, Don't look at that and say, oh, I got 500 emails today about immigration. Wow, that's interesting. They're not going to sit down and read the 500 emails. That's the first thing you need to know. An email is great. It's very convenient for us. But they know, as we know, that many of these emails are generated by activist groups. And they're just saying, drop this into an email and send it to your representative. It really doesn't go much of anywhere. What senators and members of Congress pay a lot of attention to is when their offices are clogged because the phones will not stop ringing. When the phone rings in a Senate office or a member of the House of Representatives, there's a person there, bless their hearts, and I mean that quite sincerely. Their whole job is to answer that phone and write down if this person is a constituent or not. So don't waste your time calling the senator from California if you don't live there. And they want to know, are you a constituent? And where are you're calling about an issue? Where are you on that issue, pro or con? And they will provide their boss with a tally at the end of the day about, we got 700 calls today, and 640 of them were against this bill. You probably want to know that. They know that for people who take the action to call, there are 25 or 50 more who probably feel the same way but did not pick up the phone. And so these, go find that document, Indivisible. It will give you very specific things that you can do to lobby your member of Congress or your senator. And remember, you don't have to go to Washington to do this. David Price has an office here in Chapel Hill. I don't know where the closest office for Senator Tillis is. Aaron is still here, folks. He's just nodding. Do you know
it's
where
true.
The closest office is for Senator Tillis? I'm going to say it's Raleigh.
I don't, but it can't possibly be further than Raleigh. They've got to
have offices
in Raleigh.
They've got to have offices in Raleigh. It certainly is discoverable information.
Yeah.
So go locate their offices. If you want to take direct action, then go find the office, walk in. You don't have to be disruptive. Just walk in and say, I want to tell the senator I want to see a vote on this issue, or, you know, I support him. Please support Richard Burr when he's doing the right thing in the Senate Intelligence Committee. I don't agree with him about a lot, but I think he's done a pretty good job in that role.
And remember, the people always have the power. That's not a slogan.
That's right.
That's
we
an
do.
Observation.
It's exactly
true.
Right. It's exactly right. And
yep.
too often— we are willing to hand it over. And right now we're going to have to, I'm going to have to hand over the power to the clock, which tells me that my time is up. I'm so sad to say, with my good friend Aaron Keck, thank you so much for educating our listeners. We need to do this. We could learn the whole government in 12 shows. Your government in 12 shows. So thank you once again, and thanks everybody for listening to the Weekend Water Cooler. Our next seminar will be conducted next week, and we'll see you then.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.